Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming today in what's going to be an informative talk on coup, king, crisis. What's next for Thailand? But before I begin, can I just ask everyone to silence your mobile phones or turn them off? And also, an upcoming event on Monday, we have Mike Chinoy, Assignment China, A Tale of Two Chinas. We still have seats left, so please come to that. It's been a year since the May 22nd coup. By the Thai military and system, there's been heightened concern about the future of Thailand. We're about to find out where it's all headed with our speaker, Pavan Chachavaphongpon. Pavan has spoken at the club, I think this is his third time, on various Thai-related themes. And today he's going to talk about the country's political climate, including the motivations that sparked the latest coup, the power struggle between the old guard and the new, and the ailing health of the Thai king. That's all contributed to a lot of uncertainty over Thailand's future. Pavan's an academic and associate professor at the Center of Southeast Asian Studies at Kyoto University. As many of you know, he's based in Japan because there's a warrant out for his arrest that was issued by Thailand. Not only that, they've revoked his passport. So he's essentially a refugee, and it's all because the political scholar shared his outspoken views against the military. Fortunately, none of such efforts have stopped him from sharing his views. Let's hear what he has to say. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Van Chachavaphongpon.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back to this place once again. I was told by the organizer that usually they will not invite anyone too often. So this is my third or fourth time, I can't remember. It might be my last time. hopefully I will not be arrested after this. Thank you for your kind introduction. Let me just explain to you a little bit. The coup took place on the 22nd of May last year. I was in Taiwan, just attending a conference. That night, I really had a good time, eating hot pot because it was my last night in Taipei. It was about celebration. And then suddenly someone rang me and said that there was a coup in Bangkok. I was very excited, I know it sounds really bad to be excited about having a military coup in my home country. But as an academic, I thought that, this would be another excellent opportunity to look into the political development in Thailand. Not knowing that, being excited on that day, and then 2 days later, my life would turn upside down. 2 days later, the junta issued a summon for me to report myself in Bangkok. And at the time, I was already back to Kyoto. So I thought it was a joke. In a sense that, the last time the Thai state harassed Thai academic, that was some sort of 30 years or 40 years ago. We are talking about 21st century. And as an academic, I could not see myself as a threat to the Thai state. So I thought it was a joke. So I said it on my Facebook that, dear General, I'm sorry, I am busy teaching in Kyoto. I would like to send my pet dog, a Chihuahua, to represent me in Bangkok. I thought it was a joke, and the Time and Economist picked this story up and write about it, about a Thai academic wanting to send a Chihuahua, to Bangkok to represent him. But then it turned out that it was not a joke at all. Then came second summon a week later. Again, I rejected the summon because once again, I believe I did not do anything wrong. Then, on the 13th of June, they issue a warrant for my arrest, which is valid for 10 years. And on the 9th of July last year, my passport was revoked. And that situation forced me to apply for a refugee status with the Japanese government. Okay, here I am. So, now, apart from my personal story, let's discuss about the topic. Which I have been studying and following quite closely, in the past few years. Once again, want to recap what happened in Thailand. It has been more than a year now since the last coup. I can't remember how many coups Thailand had, since 1932. Again, I told my student, I lost count What I know is that, you know, we still hold that record of having the most coup in ASEAN, in the whole of Southeast Asia. I think maybe 20 or 21 coups altogether. I'm never proud of that. But the coup last year, obviously, you know, overthrew the elected government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. You know, prior to that, there's so many months of relentless protests led by the opposition, which form an anti-Yingluck movement, you know, under the name PDRC, or the People's Democratic Reform Council, successfully created a violent context for the military to intervene. And eventually, the military did intervene, once again, on the 22nd of May. The military then led many Thais to believe that, well, this was just another normal coup, you know, basically just to get rid of bad politician like Thaksin, like Yingluck. So, you know, don't panic. We just have another coup, and then Thailand once again would return to normal. Seriously, many Thai thought about that, you know, since we have had 20 or 21 coups, so why not another coup, right? Life will just go on. But here's my argument. The objective of the latest coup indeed went beyond the simple overthrowing of the Yingluck government. In the past more than 10 years, the electoral successes of Thaksin Party, if you remember Thai Rak Thai 2001, the PPP, the People's Power Party in 2007, the Pheu Thai 2011, they had been so successful in the game of electoral politics. Once again in 2001, 2005, then 2006, they won again, you know, in 2007, and lately with Yingluck in 2011. All this served as justification for the royalist elite, of which the military is a part, right, to find ways to constrain what they believe to be the threat from the majoritarian democracy. This is particularly crucial during which time the royal succession is imminent. So we are approaching the royal succession, right? So I would first argue that the coup 2014 was staged mainly for the military and the traditional elite to take control of the royal transition. And I think this is what makes the coup of 2014 quite different from the one in 2006. And in so doing, they aim to eliminate the Shinawatra family as well as critic of the old establishment before the succession could take place. And that also includes academics like myself who have been very critical of the military and the monarchy. As I see it, the military will attempt to do two things from now on. There would be sort of two strategies for the military, and you know, just to clarify once again, Thailand is still under the military government of General Prayut Chan-o-cha. The first strategy is to try to attempt to stay in power for as long as possible. Hopefully, once again, to be in charge of the royal succession so that they would be able to manage the royal succession to ensure that they would also be able to protect their power interests when the current king passes from the scene, right? That lead to the second strategy. Should the military be forced to step down for whatever reason, for example, domestic or international pressure, right? The military would want to put in place what I would call a political infrastructure, so as to allow the military, the elite, to manipulate the electoral game even when they are not actually in power. So they would set up sort of an infrastructure to allow themselves to continue to intervene in politics. And through this process, they would do it with the rewriting of the constitution mainly. So you see the two strategies here, stay in power for as long as possible. If not, they have to put an infrastructure through the writing of the constitution that would benefit the traditional elite. Should they be forced to step down. The process begins with the constitution drafting. I don't have time to elaborate on that those kind of tactics because of time limitation. But for example, they are planning to empower the Senate, okay, by using the Senate to be an instrument of the traditional elite in order to counterbalance future government. They would also encourage future member parliament to be independent candidates. They do not have to ally with any other political party. This is because they want to break up the domination of big political party like those of Thaksin. You know, they just want to avoid this so-called majoritarian democracy. Also, future prime minister, they do not have to be an elected member parliament. So this would allow all ministry men, you know, for example, like Prayut himself, to be able to return to power after the election, right? Then also kind of like empowering other independent organizations and extra parliamentary institutions, once again, to be an instrument of the traditional elite. For example, they would like to give more power to the National Anti-Corruption Commission, the Human Rights Commission, the Election Commission, the Constitutional Court. Believe it or not, all these organizations have been working on behalf of the traditional elite at least in the past 10 years. So they would continue to empower this independent organization. Just to make the life of future government difficult, right? Now going back to the role of the military. As I said earlier, that it should not be a surprise, you know, for Thailand to have after the election, right? Now supposed to be sometime next year. It should not be a surprise that we will have a retired military leader as prime minister after the election. It should not also be a surprise either, you know, for we have a governing body of the coup maker under the name of NCPO, the National Council for Peace and Order. It sounds a bit weird, but if you remember SLOC of Burma, Myanmar, if you remember SPDC, basically this kind of same political beast, right? No one really talk about what would be the future of NCPO. So, and also the Article 44, that give a sweeping power to the military. Article 44 came to replace the martial law, which was abolished sort of 2 months ago. Again, no one really talk about what would be the future of the NCPO and also Article 44. We're not talking about this because we really have an impression that the NCPO would continue to exist even when we have a new government, because this would once again allow the military to come back to politics, including Article 44 as well. Article 44 could still be in place because after the election, there could be a number of groups coming out to protest against the constitution, against the future government, because they cannot do so right now, right? They believe that, I mean, and especially the constitution right now, we do not know whether it will go through the referendum or not. As far as I heard, it will not go through the referendum. So we cannot really claim legitimacy to the constitution. So I think the military kind of like aware of the potential protests against the whole process. That's why maybe the Article 44, once again, might still be in place. This says the military will keep its political influence after the election. Re-establishing military power in politics is so essential for the future of the armed forces, especially when Thailand is going through a transition from a long reign of King Bhumibol into the next reign under, hopefully, Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn. A claim of being a defender of the throne has always been a reason for the army, the military, to intervene in politics. And in return, the endorsement of King Bhumibol is so essential for the coup makers to claim sovereign legitimacy. But such a reason may not be sustainable with a less popular monarch. We're talking about the new king, right? Now, that is about the military. I already touched upon a little bit about the monarchy. The next section would be specifically about the Thai monarchy, the royal institution. As I argued earlier, the coup was staged in order for the traditional elite to oversee the royal succession. And in the process, the military has to be in charge and enemies have to be eliminated. And we have seen this process of enemy eliminations at least in the past 4 or 5 years, you know, if you also included the 2006 military coup that overthrew Thaksin government, then you would also see recently Ying Luck being impeached, right? She has been banned from politics for 5 years. Somchai Wongsawat, also a Thaksin brother-in-law and also former prime minister, now he has gone into this investigation process of another charge, you know, involving the electoral fraud. Not to mention also that Somchai was also ordered by the Constitutional Court to step down from the premiership in the end of 2008. Then we're talking about the Pheu Thai, the former ruling party. Member of the Pheu Thai have been under investigation right now, you know, for all sorts of charges. Red Shirt Network, a movement which has been kind of a power base of Thaksin, have been destroyed since the coup. You know, no one knows so much about it. No news report on the newspaper. But we know for sure that the troops were sent to the north and the northeastern part of Thailand. This has been the heartland of the Chinawat in order to destroy the Red Shirt Network. So, and also, you know, other kind of elimination measure, for example, using Lex Majeste law, you know, in order to silence, you know, critics of the monarchy and also the military. Then we have to look at, we have to ask ourselves, with all these different tactics, you know, military coup, judicial coup, using Lex Majeste law, why the royal succession is just so important, so crucial for the Thai power holders. I must emphasize that the upcoming royal succession, should it be a normal royal succession, it would be the first normal royal succession since 1925. That was when the throne was passed from King Rama the VI to King Rama the VII. But after that, the royal succession had been sort of irregular or abnormal, if you would want to call Rama the VII abdicating, and Rama the VIII, we know what happened. You know, he found dead, you know, in his own room, a topic that we are not allowed to discuss in Thailand. So it has always been irregular. So that's why I think when it happened the last time, the normal one in 1925. Thai people kind of like have lacked this memory or experience of having to go through normal royal succession. And because of this, I think it's kind of like raised up the level of anxiety on the part of the traditional elite as much as to the Thai public. King Bhumibol, right, is today the world's longest reigning monarch, crowned in 1946. He has been able to transform the monarchy from an unpopular establishment into becoming the country's most powerful political institution. But as we know, you know, his era is coming to an end. He is frail, ill, you know, has been in and out of hospital since 2009. Only last month that, you know, he transferred back to his seaside resort of Hua Hin. And for a long, long time that we have not seen the images of the king and the queen. This is for the first time we saw the photos, and frankly speaking, it shocked a lot of people in Thailand. I just leave it like that. His recent annual birthday speech on the 5th of December was canceled last year. Again, this is something that the Thai people have been looking forward to in the whole year, you know, to hear what the king has to say. But he has been unable to do so, you know, and in particular last year. This heightened the public anxiety over the future of Thailand without the charismatic king. Ironically, the anxiety, you know, derived mainly from the king himself, his own successful reign. In other words, he has become too successful. When become too successful and no one could really follow up to his success, that become a problem. You know, in the past several decades, the royal elites and the military embarked on recreating a certain persona of the king. You know, at one level, he has become sort of semi-god, and at the same time, he has always been people, you know, the king's people as well. His periodic intervention in politics, most recently in 1992 and in 2006, the previous coup, was interpreted as necessary step to prevent or end political violence. This kind of interpretation provided a legitimate pretext for his political involvement against the constitutional role, constitutional rule of the king being above politics. But the royal transition is happening and far from being a trouble-free process. The construction of a perfect king, a perfect Bhumibol, will prove to be a dangerous entrapment for the only heir apparent, Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn, because the Crown Prince is an opposite image of his father, and the inability of the Crown Prince to fit in that perfect mold crafted by the palace trigger once again public anxiety about Thailand under his future reign. Unfortunately, palace propaganda based around excessive glorification of King Bhumibol through national education and mainstream media has been in recent years more aggravated. I mean, this is kind of quite ironic. You're coming to the end of the era. Instead of talking more about the next king, you continue to, you know, go back into the past and then talk more and more about King Bhumibol. This led to a rigid perception of an immaculate monarch. Anything less than King Bhumibol will not be accepted. Certainly, this definitely posed a serious challenge to Vajiralongkorn to follow in the footsteps of his father, matching his father, you know, popularity and clever, you know, political maneuverings will represent a formidable obstacle for Vajiralongkorn, because all these qualities are non-transferable and they are personal property. The circumstances surrounding the royal transition, you know, offer only a few choices. I would say two choices for the future king of Thailand. And given the fact that he lacked that quality, I should have thought that the only way to go for the future king is to endorse a reform of the palace, to be totally, you know, really seriously above politics and work within the constitution. Somehow, I don't think it appeared to be like that. Vajiralongkorn recently, he tried to intervene in politics. That seemed to suggest that he could also be interested in politics like his father. As part of his search for a new role in the period leading up to the royal succession, the Crown Prince expressed concern, you know, for the potential political violence during the protests prior to the coup, by trying to be kind of like a mediator in the conflict. Then he summoned the police chief of the day, his name is Kamronwit, to try to, you know, convey a message to the protester that, you know, you please find a peaceful solution to the problem. But the choice of Kamronwit was controversial, because in Thailand, people know that the former police chief was a close aide or a close confidant of Thaksin. So because the Crown Prince picked someone from the Thaksin faction, that even deepened the rumor of a special kind of relationship between the Crown Prince and Thaksin. That has always been rumors in Thailand anyway. And because of that, you know, his role, his to show his leadership, I think it's fair. The role of the military is traditionally crucial in the support of the monarchy, including with King Bhumibol as well. He has been able to dominate Thai politics mainly because of the support of the army. Because of that, I think the military would play a crucial role in strengthening the royal institution in the future. I will spend the last few minutes trying to sum up with what will happen from now. But looking back with the role of the military and also the alliance with the monarchy, you also have to understand that the Crown Prince has never been much like, not just among the public, but also within the military as well. The Crown Prince has been isolated by the military, even though, you know, he also holds so many top ranks in the army. To empower his own position, the Crown Prince set up his own military unit many, many years ago in 1978. And we call this particular unit Royal Guard 904. 904 sort of a code for the Crown Prince, right? In April 2014, during the protests as well, a month before the coup, the Crown Prince announced a new recruitment to his army, hoping to attract those in Thailand's rural north and northeast region, the heartland of the Chinawas, as I said. But somehow this particular unit, now consisting of about 5,500 members, have been very unpopular, partly because it was seen as hostile to the National Army. So without the support from the military and the palace, the Crown Prince therefore previously, you know, have to look for alliance with Thaksin, you know, and to see this alliance as sort of strategic. Since Thaksin commanded a popular mandate through successive electoral winnings, leaning toward Thaksin could also mean gaining that same popular support. So the evidence was reflected in the gradually growing admiration of the Crown Prince among the Red Shirt supporter. If you follow Thai politics so closely, you would see that a lot of Thai Red Shirt, you know, would wear the Red Shirt together with here a big, you know, kind of screening saying we love the Crown Prince. I mean, this kind of thing quite absurd, you know, quite confusing, because, you know, on the other hand, you have Yellow Shirt royalists wearing the same T-shirt in yellow and say we love the king. And now at another corner, you know, someone wearing red shirt saying that we love the Crown Prince. So, I mean, it's very, very interesting and at the same time confusing. But the 2014 coup has really compelled the Crown Prince to shift his political alliance. Now that the military is in charge, he seemed to be to have reached out to the military government of Prayut Chan-o-cha in order to ensure his endorsement, the endorsement of his succession. For example, the Crown Prince agreed to preside over the inauguration ceremony of the National Legislative Assembly in August 2014. To many people, this seemed to legitimize the coup and the military regime, and the Crown Prince has never come out to condemn the coup in the public. On that occasion, Vachiralongkorn also urged members of the assembly to bring Thailand back to a stable track. He also divorced, you know, his wife. This has also made, you know, a headline in Thailand as well in December last year. Princess Sirat, reasoning that her relatives have done some damage to the dignity of the monarchy. They were also accused of exploiting the name of the Crown Prince for their own financial benefit. What also quite interesting is the fact that the whole family of the former wife, they have been charged with lese majesté too. I mean, this is something that we still talk about that in Thailand. You know, who could have filed a lese majesté complaint to a former wife of the Crown Prince had the instruction not been from the top and the top and the top? So we could talk about this during the Q&A. But just enough to show that, you know, I think it seemed that the transition has already started with the Crown Prince, you know, shifting the position toward the military, working to endorse the military government, including, you know, divorcing his wife and cleaning his house. I'm really coming to the end of my talk now. Well, talking about the future Thailand with the heir apparent, which might not be of any one test, what about other alternatives to the Crown Prince? There are also about a lot of talks in Thailand as well about other candidates, other more popular candidate, and that has been his popular sister, Princess Mahachakri Sirinthorn. She has always been recognized as a more suitable candidate to the throne, you know, following her own successful makeover as sort of humble, you know, down-to-earth princess, Ala Phumipon. But a hurdle is how to overcome the constitutional constraint of prioritizing male heir over female candidates. You know, we say it so clearly in the succession law and in the constitution that the priority has to go to the male heir apparent. A greater problem will also rest on a possible fallout, you know, within the royal family. As an heir apparent, it is quite unlikely that the Crown Prince will walk away quietly from his legitimate kingship. And the selection of sister over the brother, you know, will instigate a power struggle in the palace, therefore deepening a vulnerable position of the monarchy at the twilight of the Phumipon period. The implications of the royal succession shown through the military occupation of political power, the politicization of the monarchy, and also the power rearrangement within the palace seem to reaffirm the importance of the royal institution as an important part of Thai politics. And this may prove that the idea of abolishing the monarchy is still quite immature, even though we know that there would be a lot of problems associated with the royal family. The real stake lies at the vision of the new monarch, whoever it will be, you know, to encounter, to try to tackle the problem and also ensure that the monarchy is compatible with democracy. Conclusion. The prospect of Thailand's democracy at this crucial period of royal transition is rather dim, right? I'm quite pessimistic about that. The royal elite, you know, the conservative middle class and their movement have helped strengthen the power position of the old power, especially the military and the monarchy, to bring them back on the center stage of Thai politics. The new constitution, which I mentioned at the beginning, the new electoral system, and also other independent organizations will help them retain their domination. Thailand will evolve into sort of authoritarian regime, you know, in disguise, even after the election. And the fact that the new monarch is also interested in reconciliation with the military will not help Thailand and the situation either, either in the short run or in the long run. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pavan. Time for Q&As. Please raise your hand and identify yourself and the media outlet if you are with one. Oh, Keith already.
Well, Keith Bradshaw, New York Times. Just to raise a question, I guess we were discussing up here. Why do you think the Thai government is finally seeming to do something about human trafficking regarding the Rohingya? And what is the public sentiment? Is it easier for a military government to crack down on this human trafficking because it's not subject to democratic sentiments that might be hostile to Muslim immigration into southern Thailand? Or is it harder for a military government to do anything about this because of possible involvement of its own personnel in the trafficking itself?
It could be both. I think the Rohingya issue in Thailand, obviously it has been under the spotlight, you know, in recent weeks. Once again, has been a very contentious issue in my own country. I don't think though it had never been top agenda for this particular government, mainly for the fact that the government had to handle so many issues at the same time, right? I mean, domestic, resentment, talking about the legitimacy of the military coup, talking about royal succession, they do not have time to deal with the Rohingya issue, frankly speaking. I'm not sure whether they really understand the Rohingya issue either. I am not so sure about the extent to which the military government is interested in working with international organizations and also working with this sort of humanitarian issue. Once again, I don't think it has been the top priority of the government. At the public level, I'm sorry to say that, you know, we have little sympathy. Excluding me. But we, in terms of, you know, the Thai public, have little sympathy toward the Rohingya for a number of good reasons. For example, the Rohingya have been perceived as sort of economic burden for a number of Thais, you know. And on top of that, this is about the religious / ethnic and also political issue. Not to mention that Thailand has also encountered with its own problem with the Muslim community in the southernmost provinces of Thailand. There have been a lot of rumors and talks, allegations about the possibility of the Rohingya would become a part of the southern insurgency. I don't know whether it is true. I have not looked into it. But the talking about it, the allegation against it, that would be enough to serve as a justification for the current government to either abandon them, to kick them out, you know, or whatever reason, you know, that would not recognize the Rohingya refugee. As for about a trafficking business, I don't know whether I am qualified to talk about this because, frankly speaking, I know little about this. Yes, but we have found a number of proof, including, as we discussed earlier, about, you know, dead bodies of large number of Rohingya, you know, in the southern part of Thailand. That seems to suggest that, yes, the trafficking business involving the Rohingya could be real. and the scale of the atrocities could also suggest the involvement of, if not high-ranking officials, but definitely this could not be done at the low level. Thank you.
Any more questions? Gentleman there.
Swadehap. Thank you for coming again. My name is Zubair Latif. I work for the Standard newspaper here in Hong Kong. My question is, you're saying the red shirt movement has been completely destroyed, but at some point in time, do you see the government having to give some sort of election and the red shirt movement reemerging in what shape or form do you think it can reemerge in the future?
Sure. I'm sorry, I don't know whether I said completely or not. Maybe if I said that, I might have to take it back. I don't think it has been completely destroyed, but I mean to a great extent. And I know this because, you know, I have been in discussion with a number of red shirts in the North and Northeast. Then, I mean, they have difficult life right now, and then no one seems to be to pay attention to that. For example, we used to talk about a large number of red shirt villages in the North and the Northeast has been set up. You know, they would nominate someone to head that village to be the red shirt face, you know, of the whole organization. But again, they all disappeared. I'm talking about red shirt as a political movement. I think because of that, you know, we could be in serious trouble. I still believe that red shirt, a lot of them also represent pro-democracy movement. I'm not saying that all of them endorse this pro-democracy agenda, but I must say the majority of them. You can't help but to also understand that a number of red shirts are just simply pro-Thaksin and has little to do with pro-democracy as well. That also goes to say there are so many shades of red, right? From the lighter shade to the deeper shade, you know, you can starting from being pro-democracy, pro-Yingluck, pro-Thaksin, you know, anti-monarchy also. You know, it's very difficult to keep a clear definition of the red shirt movement. But when you're talking about the electoral season and they would come back once again, I mean, maybe I do not want to explain that in the context of red shirt movement. I'm just thinking that they are just, you know, a better educated rural resident of the North and the Northeast now, that they have now come to the realization that Thaksin gave them that political, a sense of political belonging. And with that sense of political belonging, they have that access to political resources in the past 10 years. And they would like to have that back once again. That's why during the election, you know, it would not be a surprise for these people to come back. But when I'm talking about, you know, being the unit being destroyed, more or less that within the notion of red shirt movement.
Any more questions? Wait, that's far, gentlemen, at the veranda.
So I understand your criticisms of the coup, but surely life in Thailand could not have gone on as it was, with both sides fighting, people, the airport closed, people fighting on the streets, people being killed. So the military coup has brought stability, and particularly when the king's health is so fragile. So, and the fact that you've had something like 21 coups, is it that Thailand is not ready for democracy?
It's a valid question. Had the military been able to bring back stability, then why it had to take them 21 times to do it? Right? If you only bring back stability, maybe one time would or two times would be enough. Because it keeps doing it and doing it and doing it. You know, that's why Thailand would never be a normal society. But I really understand your point as well. You know, at some point, you know, the political conflict has to stop. You know, because it has been ongoing since 2005, you know, up until 2014. But we have to ask ourselves as well as a Thai whether, you know, the political intervention on the part of the military is really a right, how to say, way out to the crisis. Either it is the right way to deal with the problem, or whether it would deepen the conflict. I would say that it is the latter. If anything, it deepened the already divided society, because, you know, since the coup, there is nothing but, you know, social injustice has been deepened, and also, you know, double standard. You know, whoever, you know, working with the Democrat Party, opposition party, with the anti-Yingluck movement, they seem to be okay, you know, in Thailand today, not being charged with anything, even though they're the one who created the situation in the first place. You know, and on the other hand, people from the red shirt, I'm not defending the red shirt, but I'm just trying to bring it out, you know, this is the reality in Thailand. It depends on whose side you are on. But sometimes, you know, it's too bad to be on the side of the red shirt because you would become the victim of this, you know, social injustice all the time. I might not have the answer for you, what would be the way out of the crisis, but I know for sure that political intervention of the military is not the right thing to do. I think maybe, you know, the Bangkok elite had to come to the realization that Thailand political landscape had changed so much. You know, they have to learn to compromise. They have to find a new political consensus, right? For them to start to keep faith and respect to the electoral process. You know, you cannot just keep intervening whenever you have a government that might not give you political benefit, but it might give the benefit of many people in Thailand in the rural area. You know, I guess this could be the way out for Thailand, but it would take time.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you so much. Excellent. One of the responses from Yellow Shirt is that Ying Luk presided over a catastrophic $10 billion disaster, which has brought tremendous suffering to the poor and has ruined Thailand's rice industry. So what do you say to that this woman wrecked the Thai economy with a bungled, catastrophic economic policy that the so-called elites, which they are, have said would result in exactly that, a disaster?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a tough question. She is not the brightest prime minister. She is not stupid either, right? She has something about her. I don't know. I mean, not to mention she's the first female prime minister, but I don't know whether it's matter this day talking about a female prime minister. Yeah, but I think the rice pledging scheme could have been the biggest mistake of her government for neglecting. I mean we have to also be careful about the terminology, whether this is about corruption or just negligence. As far as I know, you know, it seems like they cannot prove whether this is a case of corruption. You know, I'm not going to get into that debate. But again, whether the right pledging scheme should be responsible for her impeachment, when in reality the protester came out in the first place was not about the right pledging scheme. It was about the amnesty bill. So if you could see that there's some sort of shifting agenda here, you know, had the right pledging scheme been that damaging to the Thai economy, it should have been the first priority. It could have been the first motivation for the protester to come out on the street in the first place, but it was not. So what I am trying to say that yes, it have done some damage, but whether this is the worst damage ever to the Thai economy, I'm not sure. Whether it really, you know, kind of bringing Thai economy, you know, go down the drain, I don't know either. I don't think so. Even if it is the case, would this be the right way for the military to step in and intervene in such a way? Why can't we rely on the existing mechanism to deal with this kind of issue, corruption, if you want to say it, mismanagement? Why we have to rely on extra parliamentary institution, you know, to find a solution to us? And in fact, even the military could not find a solution to us. That's all I can say.
Hi, thank you very much. Were you suggesting that that the Crown Prince has some kind of alliance with the Thaksin faction? If so, how deep do you think that is? And would that give you any hope that when he assumes the throne, he might find some kind of political solution?
Sure. I think this is a very, very complex issue as well. And I have to say that my advice, if you talk to anyone and then that person claims to know a lot about the palace, do not believe in them, in that person, because I believe that no one really know what happened within the walls of the palace. I don't know. I could only say because of whatever I have seen, I have observed. Again, based on rumors, but in Thailand, rumors, many of the rumors become realities in Thailand too. Let me put this way: there is a possibility of this sort of political alliance between the Crown Prince and Thaksin, for the reason that I said earlier about the Crown Prince having been isolated by the royalists themselves, by the military, and that seemed to drive him to get closer and closer to the Thaksin faction. Again, for the reason that relying on Thaksin, he would hope to gain that popular mandate that Thaksin has enjoyed from the North and Northeast residents as well, right? And then the evidence to prove this, for example, he has been, the Crown Prince has been sympathetic toward the Yingluck government in the past. Even at the height of the political violence prior to the election in 2014, the Crown Prince came out to the public and said that if the police and the military, if they act too slowly to protect the safety of Yingluck, I would send my own troop to safeguard Yingluck. So I mean, you have to interpret that this is some sort of a political alliance, and not to mention that the Crown Prince allowed the Red Shirt to camp outside his palace for months and months and months against the Yellow Shirt occupation of Central Bangkok. Again, maybe you could argue that there might not be sort of association between the Crown Prince and the Red Shirt. But in Thailand, we know that you can't just go and camp outside the palace. You would be arrested, of course. The fact that you could do so for many months, once again, it seemed to suggest that kind of alliance. But here, I think that we must not also underestimate the Crown Prince too. The fact, if you believe that there would be a political alliance with Thaksin and now shifting toward the military, that seemed to suggest that he knows what's going on. And he knows which way the wind is now blowing, and he had to go toward that direction. Right now, Thailand is under the military rule. Perhaps it forced him to be more accommodating with the military. I would not be surprised if there would be an election and somehow the Thaksin people coming back once again. You would see another shift of the Crown Prince toward the new, power force. I think this what I have seen. At least in the past, few years.
It's 2 o'clock, so we can kind of nearing end of time, but we can squeeze one more question.
Just quickly, I wanted to turn that around. If the military has isolated the Crown Prince, do they have a favorite, that is, the Crown Princess?
Well, you really dropped the bomb in the last question. I mean, it has been a lot of talk about the military might favor Princess Sirinthorn, instead of the Crown Prince. And in fact, you have heard more and more, even within the anti-Yingluck protester, the PDRC, talking about the Princess Sirinthorn becoming the next monarch. She has her birthday in April. Right, and in Thailand we play with color, right? You have yellow, you have red, and it's happened that in April, and in fact the whole year would be purple, because purple is the color of the princess, and there was a campaign in Thailand, for Thai to wear purple for the month of April. But what now we in May, in June, I still see a lot of people in Thailand wearing purple. In fact, I went with my colleague to Repulse Bay, just 2 days ago, and there's a large group of Thai tourists wearing purple shirt. That has remained a wishful thinking among the military and also the Bangkok elite. Once again, I have to go back to the succession law that talks so clearly about who would become the next king. And according to the succession law, it definitely will not be the princess. Okay, and I will not want to go into the detail of what really actually happened. And then after the king passes from the scene, then there would be a parliament convening, and then the Privy Council will have to nominate the name. But in fact, to cut long story short, the person who would become the next king will have to be elevated to be the crown prince. And it has only been the prince who has been elevated in 1972. No one else has been elevated to that position, including the princess. So the talk and the rumor about the possibility of the sister becoming the next monarch, once again, has been a wishful thinking among the Thai elite. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin, for the very eye-opening talk.